Thank you. Wow. As many of you know, one of my alternative ministries, if I can call it that, during my time with you has been my involvement down in Lowell, Massachusetts, with that city's various programs and events over the years to honor the life and the legacy of their native son, Jack Kerouac. I'm going to offer my takes next Sunday on people I'm calling my two American heroes, which are Woody Guthrie and Kerouac, so you can hold that till next Sunday. But my opening story for today is about how I became involved with the organization that does all this in the first place. It's called Lowell Celebrates Kerouac. I served as their president two different terms. I no longer hold that office, but I remain involved with the committee as we produce two of these festivals a year down there. Well, my first bit of contact, though, with this organization began in the early 1990s, a little over 20 years ago now. And at the beginning, it was rather tenuous. I attended a few of their monthly meetings, but I wasn't sure it was something I wanted to get all that involved with. I'd had an interest in the writer, Mr. Kerouac, and his Beat Generation literary genre at an earlier point in my life. But by the time we had moved up here to Nashville, that interest was, it was kind of beginning to wane a little bit. Now, this admission may come as a surprise. Some of you who have the impression the first two words out of my infant mouth were Jack Kerouac, I wasn't always this way. Well, anyway, as the time was the 1993 festival, like I said, almost 20 years ago, it approached. I got a call from one of the committee members, whom I barely knew at that time, asking if I would chair a panel symposium during the festival weekend in October on Kerouac and spirituality. I'd kind of been a no-show at most of the planning meetings in the month prior, and I was really surprised to be asked. But I figured, well, maybe, what with me being a minister and all, they think I know something about the subject. So I said, okay, I'll do it. I'm easy. It wasn't until about a week or so later that I thought to ask someone on this committee who all was going to be on the panel. Turned out it was a couple of local poets, one other person, and oh yeah, Allen Ginsberg's coming. Whoa, hold on. I'm supposed to lead a symposium on Kerouac and spirituality with Allen Ginsberg. Are you kidding me? I'd always wanted to meet the guy, but to hold my own in a conversation with him in a room full of what we knew would be a very large crowd of people, that was another matter altogether. Rather than admit to these misgivings and second thoughts, though, I just said, well, hey, that's great. Day arrives, room's packed. I deliberately dressed down for the occasion, so naturally Ginsberg shows up, clean-shaven, wearing a coat and tie, playing against type of the hairy wild man poet image he had cultivated at an earlier time in his life. So I'm feeling a little overwhelmed already as he comes in and takes a seat next to me, and I look up, and sitting on the front row is one of Kerouac's principal biographers, woman who is generally regarded as one of the better informed historians of that whole era. And she's got her notepad and pencil all poised, and I look a few seats behind her, and there is a woman I actually recognized from pictures as one of Mr. Kerouac's girlfriends from around that time in his life, the same time of the life we were going to be talking about. Well, for me, it was one of those classic, dear Lord, what am I doing here, moments. And I began to wonder if there was, you know, like a back door I could slip out before somebody discovered that I was an imposter, in order to look like I at least knew what I was doing, in order to at least look like I knew what I was doing. I glanced down at these little prepared remarks I had there to launch the discussion, and all I could think of, what a load this is. You can't say this stuff out loud. Well, it was about that time that I gave myself a metaphorical slap upside the head and told myself to quit whining, summoned up a bit of wisdom I've long carried around, which was get this event underway and just fake it till you make it. Really, I just figured, okay, I don't quite know what I'm doing up here, but I'll act like I do and I'll see what happens. And somewhere along the way, my feelings of faking it got tamped down enough that at least I was able to enjoy mixing it up with all of those who were on that panel, including Mr. Ginsberg. But I still didn't have a good sense of how the whole event had gone Until about a week or so later, we had a follow-up meeting, kind of a post-festival evaluation time to talk about how it all went. To my surprise, a lot of the conversation was about how well that symposium had gone. People are thanking me for running the thing and all this, and I decided, well, maybe I didn't make a complete fool out of myself, you know, after all. Maybe I thought I've even got a future with this whole Kerouac Beat business. Well, I guess most of you know kind of where it went from there. A major episode of self-doubt, if not self-denigration, actually turned out to be a very pivotal moment for me. So if my course of the ministry since then, over the past maybe 20 years, my Kerouac and Beat references got a little old, you can blame it on Allen Ginsberg. I don't think he'll mind. He passed away 15 years ago this month. Well, fake it till you make it was the stance or the attitude that got me through the experience I just described. And the result of it was that it opened up a part of me that I scarcely even knew was there at the time. And I'm going to guess that a number of you have your own versions of this story. Maybe a time when you felt you really were inadequate, you didn't know how to rise to the occasion, somehow you didn't, it kind of turned around your understanding of yourself in a certain way. At least I hope you've had that kind of experience. It can be a little scary at first, but it can be very rewarding in the long run. Well, I had some hesitation, speaking of self-doubt, about even going with this sermon title today, because at first glance or first hearing, it may sound like I'm endorsing phoniness or fakery. Not really. I use the expression, as you probably already figured out, to describe a circumstance where you don't quite know what you're doing, but know you have to act anyway. Or where you don't know with absolute certainty the stance you're taking is the right one, but you still have to take a stand. For in the end, as I'm using the phrase here, fake it till you make it is not about being phony or inauthentic. Instead, it's about trusting yourself when you're in the midst of uncertain or difficult circumstances and you're trying to get your bearings. It's about cultivating the capacity or a capacity for self-trust. In the end, it's about living by faith. Now, there's a word, faith, I know gets a little troublesome for some Unitarian Universalists, but I can tell you that for all the twists and the turns my journey in the ministry has taken, or make that my whole entire spiritual journey itself for that matter, I've always considered myself, in one respect or another, a person of faith who is on a journey of faith. It's just the nature or the meaning of that faith has changed over the course of my life. So I'm going to run with that for a few minutes. As I recalled that symposium experience I just shared, I remembered something else I'd read in a book titled And a Voice to Sing With. The book is Joan Baez's autobiography. Grammatically speaking, the title should have been And a Voice with Which to Sing, but I guess if you're Joan Baez, you can make the title anything you want. In this book, she tells of occasionally having feelings before a concert similar to the ones I just described before that symposium. Some places in that book, she writes about her feelings of self-doubt, her feelings of inadequacy, her asking herself, what do I think I'm doing here, before getting ready to go on out and do a concert. I was amazed to read that. Ms. Baez has, over the past 40, probably 40 to 50 years now, one of the most clear and beautiful singing voices I have ever heard. It's dropped a register or two as she's gotten older, but still it's beautiful. And Joan Baez's mantra, as she tells it in her book here in these pre-concert moments when she's feeling inadequate, she says what she does is she just says to herself, well, put it in the hands of God, and she picks up her guitar, she walks out on stage to do her concert. Reading that got me to thinking. That happens sometimes when I read books. All right. And here comes the theological part. When I say fake it till you make it, and Joan Baez says put it in the hands of God, are we each in our own way saying the same thing? I can't say for sure, of course. I did have the pleasure of very briefly meeting this woman many, many years ago, but we didn't talk about God. I was invoking God to myself. I was 23 years old at the time, and as we were conversing, and I'm standing there trying to look like I'm a reasonably okay, sane person, I'm saying to myself, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, I'm standing here talking to Joan Baez. But at least I didn't blurt that out loud. Well, put it in the hands of God, fake it till you make it. Is this a case of different language saying the same thing? And could they both be statements of faith? I think so, depending, of course, upon what your understanding of faith is. I know among the sermons I have offered from this pulpit over the years are ones in which I have distinguished between what I call two modes of faith. So I'm going to revisit that now, one more time around. Mode one, as I call it, is a faith that is ultimately vested or anchored in the realm of the supernatural, or in whatever a person believes is above and beyond the workings of the natural world. This is usually a willful, intentional, supernatural supreme being who is ultimately in charge of everything and who gives one's life meaning and purpose and direction. In the absence of such a supreme being, life is devoid of any kind of meaning for those who hold this type of faith. You've heard all my stories from my upbringing, so you know that this is the nature of the faith in which I was first raised. And while it's a mode I no longer embrace, I do not disparage those who do. And then there's mode two faith, as I call it. And this one is located solely in the realm of the natural world and universe, acknowledging, to be sure, that there's still much we don't know about this realm of the natural world and universe. And to be a person of faith in this mode means that you trust in the human capacity for reason and in the strength of the human will and spirit, while at the same time seeking for something more beyond all that. And for me as a mode two guy, that something more I refer to is contained within the realm of the natural. It is that depth dimension to life that I call sacred or holy, and that can be touched and experienced on occasion. Now, persons in both of these faith modes can and do speak of God. Mode two people, probably a little more gingerly, a little less so than the mode one folks, but the term God can be used meaningfully with both modes, but they are speaking of different kinds of realities. In mode one, as just noted, God is a supreme being who exists outside the natural realm and who rules over the natural world and our lives as we live them in this world. In mode two, God is more likely seen as what Emerson and others called one's divine spark, or the God or Goddess within, or the blessed spirit of life about which we sing here every Sunday. And it is this inner spark, whatever term you want to give to it, this inner spark that also connects us to that which is beyond us, to what we know, and to greater mysteries that we do not yet fully know. So, I was in mode two faith back at that symposium when I figured I just got to let it go and let it happen and decide that by faith I'd still be on my feet, or at least I'd still be in my seat, when it was all done. Fake it till you make it. That is to say, believing that you will indeed make it. And I don't know for sure that Joan Baez is a mode two person of faith, but if she is, then her phrase of put it in the hands of God isn't too different from my own. Take this matter in another direction for a few minutes now. Living a faith, a life of faith as I have tried to present it here, does not shield you or protect one from doubt or betrayal. It offers no protection from being let down or letting others down, and sometimes in pretty devastating ways. For faith is not to be confused with certainty, although it oftentimes is. More often than not, when someone says they have, quote, lost their faith, what they mean is they no longer feel certain about something or someone in which they have previously vested absolute certainty. give several examples of this. Just for one, I'll go back and recall several of the articles that came out in various publications clear back in 2004, when that huge Indian Ocean tsunami hit the coast of Indonesia. I think the death count on that thing got up to something like 230,000 people. Just amazing. As I read some of the responses to that, one widespread response to this very horrible event, horrible for the people who got caught up in it, as well as for those who viewed it from afar, was, well, how on earth could God let something like this happen? Don't know that I have a direct answer to that, but I will say if one's faith is in a God who can both direct and intervene in the workings of the natural world, then it is a perfectly logical question, and certainly would test a Mode 1 type of faith. For me, as a Mode 2 faith guy, it makes more sense to recognize, however difficult it may be at times, that we live in a world and a universe that can bless us in some very wonderful, some very life-fulfilling ways at times, and in some inexplicably devastating ways at other times. I think to be a person of faith, then, is to have the internal resources to respond to both the blessings and the tragedies of life and keep on going. I got one more take on what it means to be a person of faith in this Mode 2 manner that I keep calling it. It means being willing and able to live in the zone between what you know and trust in and believe in, both about yourself and your world, and those times when you know, where what you know, trust, and believes in can leave you coming up short, sometimes painfully short. It means living in the zone between what you know and trust and believe in and what is unknown, unknowable, or mysterious, sometimes painfully mysterious. Faking it till you make it doesn't always mean you're going to make it. It just means you have to keep believing that you can. It also means that when you don't make it, there's still more life for you to go for as long as you have breath. In many of the memorial services I lead, I use that familiar passage from the book of Ecclesiastes in the Hebrew scripture that says there are times to mourn and times to dance, times to laugh and times to weep, times to receive and times to lose. We've all known these kinds of times in our ministry here together. There have been times of great joy, times to dance, times to laugh, times to receive. And there have been times of some very difficult and painful losses as well. And I will say that some of those losses have tested my faith. But the faith for me was not of a faith in a God who somehow caused those losses to occur. Since I don't believe in that kind of God to begin with, and there was no faith in that sense for me to be tested on. Now, the faith that was tested for me was my faith in our ability as both individuals and as a religious community to move through some of those trying experiences, some of those times to mourn and times to lose, until we each and all could reconnect with those wellsprings of strength and hope within us and continue to choose life again. That was the test of faith. And it was a test that I've seen passed on many, many occasions by so many of you. And I think this is one of the reasons that we are here. So we can offer and we can be this kind of a faith community when it is needed the most. So I offer this in closing. We each bring our lives here in the faith and in the hope that they will in some way be transformed. This is one of the reasons that we exist as a liberal, religious, Unitarian Universalist community. To be a place to offer a setting where people can work on transforming their lives in positive ways. And we also bring our lives here in order that we may place them, metaphorically speaking, in the hands of something greater than ourselves. We do not all call that something greater by the same name. And that is as it should be for those of us who are of a free faith. But I feel safe in saying that we do sense the reality of this something greater amongst us as an expression of our collective life. We come not always knowing for sure if we're going to make it. When it comes to the challenges, the obstacles, the losses, the defeats we each and all face at times. But we come in order to find the strength that allows us to act as if we can meet those challenges. Because when you act as if you can, most of the times you do. We come in order that our yes to life may be ours to say for as long as we're each given our time to say it. And so may the presence of this blessed Spirit of life, may it be ours, may it be yours to have and to share as you continue to grow this community of faith.